Coming. It's my great pleasure to now introduce Gareth Ito, who's been visiting the Institute since April, and is going to talk to us now about magma generation extraction at mid-ocean ridges from Shannon Hotspots.
Great, thanks. Well, I'd like to thank the organizers for putting on such a stimulating workshop, and the Isaac Newton Institute is such an incredible facility. It's been a really great way to interact with lots of people from all over the world. So. And John has been very good at keeping the group busy between the meetings, so thanks a lot. A lot of the topics, I sort of tried to hit on a lot of topics that were discussed during the last workshop and over the last couple weeks, and that Rich certainly summarized in his talk earlier. And I'm going to do it from more of a sort of a geophysical observational point of view. So I'd like to summarize some of the key recent seismic and magnetotelluric experimental results to image the melting regime at mid-ocean ridges and hotspots. And in the context of sort of geodynamic models or sort of what we think we understand about the physics of mantle flow or mantle melting and melt migration, sort of highlight what we think we are most easily readily understandable or what we can explain versus what is not. And then the questions that I'll sort of point to relate to the deep melting regime related to the release of volatiles, perhaps even fertile materials such as mafic materials, the shallow melting regime and melt migration in that melting regime, and then finally questions of pertaining to getting the melt out of the mantle and into the surface. So the first perhaps two-thirds or so I'll talk about mid-ocean ridges and getting right into that. This is shows some tomographic results of a regional surface wave study focusing around the Pacific. And what you'll notice most prevalently, this is a 2D cross-section, which is an average as a function of seafloor age in the Pacific Ocean. So the ridge axis would be here at zero age. And this is VS or VSV vertically polarized S wave speed. And the prominent observation is that the wave speeds are high near the mid part of the upper mantle, and they decrease going upward. And this is related to the decrease in pressure and temperature becoming closer to the solidus. And likewise, also from the top, the velocities are high, and they decrease going downward, primarily effect of temperature. And so what's in between is the seismic asthenosphere, starting somewhere above 200 to below, above 200 kilometers depth. And it's this low seismic velocity region where we're near or at the solidus, and perhaps there is some melt present in the mantle. And it, some people have suggested that melt may be present over very large areas of the asthenosphere. So the first sort of focus study I'd like to talk about is by the Brown group. This particular paper was by Ratney and others. And this was the GLIMPSE experiment, which was a deployment of a number of ocean bottom seismometers in young Pacific lithosphere. So this is the East Pacific Rise. This is a very fast, some of the fastest spreading lithosphere on Earth. But they were especially interested in imaging what the mantle looked like beneath this young lithosphere, and especially beneath these various seamount chains where volcanism is very young as well. And focusing first on their average depth-varying structure beneath the region. Oh, the age range is from 0 to 8 million years way out here. So this is 0 to 8 million-year-old crust. And this red curve is their average depth-varying S-wave velocity profile. And again, showing the high velocities at depth, and as well as near the surface, and the minimum velocities in the asthenosphere. And so their interpretation was that they sort of saw a transition in the VS gradient in the deeper part of their curve, and there was a transition from a relatively shallow gradient to a steeper gradient, And they interpreted that to mark the solidus for incipient melting or so. Oh, and I did want to say a little bit about seismology. So these are surface waves. And of course, the surface waves are confined to the surface. They propagate along the surface, as opposed to body waves that don't need a surface. They propagate through the whole Earth. And using different periods, longer periods are sensitive to deeper portions of the mantle. So by using different periods, they can get this sort of depth resolution. So the solutions are, of course, non-unique. But if we take this result, and as well as the error bars at face value, one could estimate a velocity perturbation that deviates from this lower gradient shown by this dashed line. Or one could use a Young geotherm and convert temperature to VS using the Fallon-Jackson parameterization that again takes into account inelasticity that Doug spoke about. And you would get something like, well, several percent variation in VS. And if one uses some sort of back of the envelope relationships between this percent VS and if it's all due to melt, then you get relatively high melt fractions. And this is all below the dry, what they infer to be the dry solidus. So there are some interesting aspects about this region that may be problematic to perhaps our understanding about permeability, or at least between the relationship of VS and different physical properties of the mantle. So it may mean that VS is very sensitive to very low melt fractions in a way that's different at higher melt fractions. I guess it's possible that there's elevated temperatures relative to this reference geotherm. I'm going to toss out the possibility that perhaps the melt fraction is relatively large, but this incipient melting zone includes small blobs or pockets of fertile material, perhaps mafic material, that actually are disconnected and can sustain high melt fractions. I wanted to show this nice image of Rich's that's sort of on the logo of the meeting, but this is a calculation showing melting of fertile heterogeneities, showing concentrated pockets of relatively high melt fraction. One of the questions I'm posing is why velocities are so low, so deep in the melting zone. And then going further up, above the dry solidus, where most of the melt should be being produced, it's interesting that the velocities on average in this area actually increase. And Forsyth and Veratney and others suggested that reflects a compositional change of the solid material, perhaps the drying out of the mantle. And so this is a compositional effect. They estimated the base of the lithosphere to be around 40 kilometers or so. So this increase is below where they would expect the thermal lithosphere to be. So it's possible. So I'll ask why the velocities are so high in the shallow part. It may be because VS is very sensitive to solid composition. It may mean that perhaps there's lower mean temperatures in the shallow upper mantle in the region. And it may be that actually porosity is decreasing, and that's an interesting concept that we'll come back to later. This is a result of their sort of lateral variations shown in this depth range where productive melting is probably occurring. And so there are large variations in velocity. If you relate it, if this is all due to porosity, then we're talking up to a couple of percent porosity variation, which again is quite high compared to what we think should be down there. It's also possible that there are variations in temperature, perhaps related to upper mantle convection, or even they proposed transport of viscous mantle fingering toward from the western Pacific towards the East Pacific rise. So there's some really interesting local and regional variability in the velocity structure. This is a tomographic global tomography result by Gu and others showing velocity variations along the Pacific at a depth of about 70 kilometers. And that could be heterogeneity or in composition or temperature, but the interesting aspect is crustal thickness is doesn't show any systematic, is more or less the same between at least that location and these locations. So the suggestion that they made was perhaps there's differences in the relationship between permeability and phi between these areas. So perhaps there's more melt here than here, but the melt flux is not very different. Okay, so the melt experiment was certainly a very important experiment in the 90s and in terms of imaging the mantle beneath a mid-ocean ridge for the first time. I'd like to present this short period love wave study by Dunn and Forsyth. And this was an experiment in which here's the melt array, the ocean bottom seismometers. And they looked at two events and love waves traveling from those events to the array. And between each event and each station, you get an average love wave speed, again for different periods. And the differences across the array allowed them to produce, along axis averages in the seismic velocity as a function of distance across the ridge. And this was their key result. The melting depths inferred from petrology would be, you know, above 70 or so kilometers up to the base of the lithosphere, but they see this very concentrated low velocity region very near the base of the crust, which they interpreted it to indicate an increase in porosity as you move shallower into the shallow crust, or to the base of the crust. And so this variation from here to here at a depth around 40 kilometers is something like 4 to 5%, and it gets much slower than that, closer to the surface. So again, we're talking about large changes in seismic velocities that we need to understand better in terms of interpreting porosity and permeability. Another part of the melt experiment was a body wave PNS body wave tomography. They are sensitive to deeper in the mantle over a broader area. This is results from the melt study, and this is a result produced by the Brown group of a joint surface and body wave tomography, again extending, not having the detail in the shallow structure that the Dunn and Forsyth study had, but having more information deeper into the mantle. And what impresses me is the breadth of what one might interpret as the incipient melting zone, which is expected to be somewhere below 100 kilometers. Here's the peak in seismic velocity that was imaged by Wiratney and others. And so this suggests that the incipient melting zone can make a big influence on seismic velocity. It's very broad. And in this case, it's asymmetric. And this was explained by Condor and others, as well as Toomey and others, by strong eastward mantle flow, an ambient mantle flow that's rather strong. I guess I'm doing pretty good on time. I just wanted to show you, this is the region sort of imaged here, and so you can see this low velocity that extends further west of the ridge axis. So both, so the incipient melting zone seems to be quite large, and it's heavily influenced by the dynamics of the mantle, right? So the mantle flow can impart a significant difference. Oh, there is also the possibility of elevated temperatures from the Western Pacific mantle. Okay, so now I'd like to talk about this resistivity image that Doug talked about. This was done by an MT experiment around 9 degrees north. This is where electromagnetic fields from the atmosphere come down and are sensed by instruments on the seafloor. and that energy propagates through the Earth, and from that they can estimate resistivity structure. And I'm going to, as Doug sort of did, I'd like to just sketch out what they wrote in their paper about inferred melt percents. The deepest red here in this very low resistivity region could have up to 10% melting if they used the simple relationships they did in terms of relating log or resistivity to melt fraction. This is the region of productive, highly productive melt region above the dry solidus. Below the dry solidus, they inferred a wet melting regime or a incipient melting regime. So these yellow colors, they would infer, would be something like a few percent porosity, which again is quite high. And then they actually saw this very deep portion of even lower resistivities, which I don't remember what they said about resolution, but they certainly talked about it. And so they suggested this is the carbonate melting zone, and with lower porosities. So again, this incipient melting zone seems to have a very strong signal in the resistivity structure. Another interesting aspect of the study was that the resistivities got quite high, well below what one might infer to be the thermal lithosphere. And so they attributed that to, again, dehydration of the residue, but this might suggest that there's no porosity or very little melt in this region. One aspect that's been studied over the years, and perhaps with these sorts of images, we can place constraints on the melting regime or the dynamics or even rheology of the mantle, and that's the width of this high productivity melting zone. One could put numbers if one wants to attribute a contour to the melting zone or not, but it's in the range of 100 to 150 kilometers, both in the seismic and MT results. And some of the what we know about what controls this width of the high productivity melting zone has to do with rheology and buoyancy. So this is some seminal work by Mark, and he showed that if you take some N-member situations, here we have sort of isoviscous flow, but it's a high viscosity, and therefore the flow is driven passively by the separation of the two plates. The white curves here show the streamlines, and the colors here show a relatively broad melting zone, basically showing everywhere there's upwelling that's above the solidus. The other end member is a situation in which buoyancy caused by melt retention drives a strong convective upwelling. And in that situation, one can get he showed a case in which one could tend to localize the upwelling and get a very narrow melting zone. So Rich Katz, a few years ago, sort of put in a more complete sort of physical disk model of the mantle. So he included temperature-dependent viscosity and included melt percolation with compaction. And he actually looked quite carefully at how the width of this melting zone was controlled by the relative importance of this buoyancy-driven upwelling versus spreading rate. And his estimates, if you look at the appropriate spreading rates, were within a factor of two of what you see here. They're actually a little bit wide compared to the results of the MT and the seismic results. This is a way in which we can perhaps use these observations to understand the melting regime. So another problem that has been influenced the community over the last couple decades is how we get melt from a relatively broad melting zone to, you know, within a few kilometers of the ridge axis. And just to run through some ideas that were presented, the first is ridge suction. If we have a high viscosity mantle, as Rich mentioned, we have a low pressure region beneath the ridge axis. And the black lines here show marks predicted streamlines for the melt. So you can draw melt from a broad region here. Another way of focusing the melt to the ridge axis is just to do it with solid state flow. You focus the upwelling to the ridge axis. Mark Spiegelman and Mark Parmentier have also worked on the possibility of channeling along the base of a thermal lithosphere, and that's in Rich's calculations here. So you get melt percolating up to a strong permeability boundary, and you form a channel that with buoyancy will tend to move the melt to the ridge axis. And if one wanted to sort of compare these images, some of these look more like the MT results, others don't. But this particular mechanism has a problem with this high resistivity region below the base of the thermal lithosphere. And it's interesting that either the seismic results nor the MT results, show peaks in inferred melt content at shallow depths. They're all sort of down here near the dry solids, whatever that means. Sam Butler and his student recently published a paper on the possibility of anisotropic melt permeability, and Sam's going to talk about this later, in which the formation of melt bands associated with shearing can lead to a preferential channeling in a certain direction. That's another topic of active research. It also places some of the sort of basic physical processes that Rich talked about in a context of a natural system. And then the other aspect that by Turner et al., and you're going to hear a talk about that, I guess this next, I guess, right, is the effects of grain size dependent permeability. And I'm not going to talk about that because I'll let you hear about that next. And so in terms of how far from the ridge the melts can come, Mark Bain recently applied his new sort of melting parameterization, which is designed to explain major element compositions from laboratory experiments. And one of their main conclusions was that it's explained the data was best fit if you excluded some of the outer portion of the melting regime, and perhaps as much as 20 to 40% of the sides of the melting zone the melt from there didn't actually make it to the ridge axis. Okay, so that's pertaining to the topics of the deep and shallow melting regime. I wanted to talk a little bit about getting melt out of the mantle and what the observational constraints were on those. This is a study by Dunn and Forsyth, looking at an active source tomography experiment on the East Pacific Rise, where they can really solve for the velocity structure of the crust and the very shallowmost upper mantle. And this is the scale of this cross-section compared to the MT results. So it's really focusing at the getting the melt into the crust. And you can see that it's focused within, several, maybe 20 kilometers of the ridge axis, just below the depth, below the base of the crust or the MOHO. It's also quite uniform along this 30 kilometer length of the East Pacific Rise. So, the melt is very focused. And there's two zones where the melt seems to be pooling, one at the lithologic boundary at the base of the crust and one in the shallow crust. And so the thermomechanics of that is not well understood, what controls the depth of pooling. Another result, this time by Dunn, Dietrich, and Toomey, image did a similar experiment for the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And they this is a 3D cross section. So this is along the ridge axis. So the ridge axis would be here. This is the result in map view. So this is an axial valley of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge and various depth cross sections. And they show evidence for highly focused melt delivery to the crust at the segment center. And this is seen by both a thick crust near the center of the segment, as thick as 8 to 9 kilometers, and thinner crust near the segment end. But they also see these low seismic velocities, which are either heated crust or partially molten crust, and in mantle even. So there's some process about slow spreading ridges that tend to focus melt along the axis to the segment center. Either it's upwelling in the mantle or some sort of shallow melt delivery system. Okay, and one could put numbers on the percent of melt in this column, and they estimated an average of 3%. An experiment that I participated in, and actually Mark Bain did as well, a decade and a half ago or so, but this was published just recently because Pablo finally was able to produce the results. This is the Galapagos Spreading Center, and this is an intermediate spreading center influenced by the Galapagos hotspot. So there's an interesting trend in ridge structure and magma supply along the ridge axis. And I guess perhaps to simplify the story, if this is a velocity perturbation relative to a depth average for each section, and you see large variations in seismic velocity, and certainly at least, well, a magma lens was detected using seismic reflection in this area as well as in this area, and those are located right here and here. There was not a magma lens reflector up here, but there's these variations in seismic velocities could reflect, probably do reflect ponding of melt in these two sections in the shallow crust, and probably reflect ponding of melt again at the base of the crust at MOHO levels. So there are there's evidence that melt tends to pool at various depths, near the one being near the base of the mantle, also pool at various levels in the crust. So I would ask, there's some thermomechanical processes that control that, and this leads to the question of what those are, and eventually they'll erupt, and that's a whole other dynamical process that we're also going to hear about later. I'd like to present one more study that's just in press in Nature Geoscience. This is by the University of Oregon. Vanderbeek's a student working with Doug Toomey, and they did a local seismic study of the Juan de Fuca Ridge, which is just in this section, is just offshore Washington. And this is the ridge segment that's sort of curved, and it's bounded by two overlapping spreading centers. So the dashed lines are the axis of seafloor spreading. And they image the very much upper mantle with PN or refracted waves in the upper mantle. And what's peculiar is the zone of lowest seismic velocities occurs in the overlapping sections of the segment, not in the center, unlike very different from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and also different from that section of the East Pacific Rise. They emphasize this result along with previously published results by Toomey and others, also showing evidence for elevated melt content in the mantle beneath this overlapping spreading center. And again, the crustal thickness is not higher here. The melt supply isn't any higher. In fact, it's lower in some places. So they again infer something about the thermal mechanical processes of that tectonic offset that influences how easily melt is extracted out of the mantle. Okay, so that's what I'd like to present to you, and perhaps engage some of your thinking about mid-ocean ridges. Now let's talk about oceanic hotspots. And the biggest challenge we've sort of addressed in oceanic or hotspots in general is what they are. There's a lot more heterogeneity involved, so there's a lot less known about or that we can infer to this date about melt migration. But I've worked a fair amount about the melt generation processes. And so talking first about Hawaii, there's this sort of classical work by a group of a few, some of the most of which are listed here. So Neil, Reby, Sleep, Olson, and Davies sort of showed in the 80s how the characteristics of the hotspot swell and the general age progression of ocean islands, such as Hawaii, is relatively well explained by a focused thermal upwelling, or plume if you want to call it, that's hitting the base of the lithosphere and spreading out like a sheared pancake. And this of course has guided a lot of thinking about how we think melting and mantle flow works beneath hotspots. Neil produced a nice paper studying the melting regime in intraplate hotspots. This is a plot of temperature and map view with the plume sort of centered here, and this is the sheared hot pancake. Plate motion would be to the left here, explaining this seafloor swell. The melting zone is shown by these contours, and this is a close-up viewed in cross-section showing the hot upwelling plume being sheared by the overlying plate, and the melting zone that can explain the dominant volcanism, for example, near the Big Island. And it was also interesting that they also predicted this sort of very low amount of melting well downstream of this main melting zone, and suggested that an explanation for explaining a rejuvenated or secondary volcanism that occurs up to 2 million years after the main shield building phase. It turns out that secondary volcanism is quite, although it's voluminously small, it's quite aerially extensive. And that's a very active issue, and certainly in Hawaiian volcanism. Okay, so the problem is that the Hawaiian plume doesn't look like this. And if we sort of sketch a small version of the Reby model, it looks more like this. These are tomographic results from the plume experiment, which was led by Cecily Wolf. Dietrich was there, Solomon, Dave Berkovici was on the project, and a number of other people, Woods Hole. This is a deployment of ocean bottom seismometers for 2 years for two different arrays. And the results I'm showing here are the results of the S body wave inversions. And so this is a cross-section along the chain. So this would be southeast down here. This is northwest. And this big red blob is a low-velocity body beneath the swell. And the first thing you'll notice is that low-velocity blob, if you, again, take it at face value, is much too thick to be explained by a high buoyancy thermal plume being impinging on the base of the lithosphere. That was one problem with this result in terms of explaining it. And the other aspect was the low-velocity blob in map view was bilaterally asymmetric. And if we superimpose contours of seismic velocity taken at 200 kilometers depth, you see that the lowest velocities correspond to regions where the topographic swell is shallow, but you see this relatively high seismic velocities where there's a deeper swell. So there's some complexity to this, the dynamics of the plume beneath Hawaii. And so Maxine Balmer came to Hawaii and worked on this problem for a few years. And so there's been plenty of evidence for major element heterogeneity in plumes, such as Hawaii or hotspots. And so, and some early studies on the effects of the dynamics, because the presence of eclogite or mafic materials in the plume is to reduce the buoyancy of the plume. And so, taking experimental results, Maxine used these density profiles. So this would be of pyrolytic peridotite mantle, and this is the phase change, Alving-Spinell phase change at the top of the transition zone. And you can see that eclogite is everywhere denser at the same temperature and pressure than peridotite. But there's a peak in density contrast associated with this phase change and the cozite-stichovite phase change and eclogite. And so the model that he produced included these buoyancy effects. So he has a sort of sluggishly buoyant plume coming from the deep upper mantle. In this zone between 300 and 400 kilometers, there's a peak in excess density of eclogite. So this material is actually nearly neutrally buoyant. And as a result, it tends to pool in a deep eclogitic pool, as we call it, a DEP. So it tends to collect in this deep zone. So you get a large volume of hot material. And once you get above this transition, you get more buoyant material that's actually assisted by eclogite melting, which we sort of parameterized as occurring somewhere around 200 kilometers depth. So you sap even more the eclogite buoyancy once you melt that peroxide. And so then we get the Rebe buoyant pancake beneath the base of the lithosphere. Right, so it's the density and melting of this eclogite that's important. It also generates quite a bit of bilateral asymmetry. If you look at these temperature contours on this plane, you're looking from the base of the mantle up. And this is two isosurfaces of temperature. And this dark patch is where melting is occurring. So there's a fair amount of bilateral asymmetry, but it also introduces some time dependence. And so to wake you guys up, I'll show a movie of the model predictions. And so what's happening is this DEP is filling, and as it gets too big, then it starts to upwell out of the top of this, and so you get a sort of pulsing behavior between filling this DEP and draining it with enhanced upwelling. And right, so if one calculated the magma flux that resulted from this sort of more thermochemical Hawaiian plume, you get variations, excursions that are of comparable amplitude to the what's estimated based on the geologic record. So this eclogite melting could be quite important to the dynamics at Hawaii. I'm going to pass. There was a subsequent joint body wave and surface wave inversion by the Berkeley group, Richard Allen and his student Chang. And this shows the hot upwelling plume and further evidence for a deep low velocity blob. Perhaps if you wanted, perhaps evidence for even a double layering as predicted by the models. Okay, so the questions that we need to better understand is how peroxenite or eclogite influence the physical properties of the mantle, including its buoyancy, its viscosity, and seismic velocity. How do they do this in the partially molten state? What are the effects on the physical processes? At what depths do peroxenite and or eclogite begin to melt? And when do those melts start to migrate? How do those melts interact with the peridotite to generate the melts that we see at the surface? Okay, and so one might ask the question, well, how many plumes are thermochemical plumes? There's been some recent tomographic studies of other hotspots, Iceland being one, and there's no real clear evidence for any sort of deep pooling in that depth range of 300 to 400 kilometers. This is a regional, I believe it's point both surface and body wave study of the North Atlantic. This is a local tomographic study due to a local array in Iceland. So this is more like the White and Mackenzie pancake beneath the lithosphere. Nor is there any evidence for this sort of deep pooling beneath the Yellowstone hotspot. So this is a beautiful, I imagine this is this type of image is as well resolved as any other that we'll see for a while. But because the array was the whole U.S. array in all of North America, but they see this low velocity blob upon the base of it corresponding to 200 or 300 kilometers depth. and this upwelling here. And they actually think they can detect the bottom of that, so they suggest that it's a discontinuous upwelling, but it goes into the lower mantle. Now, another area that's quite interesting that I've sort of been studying for many years now, off and on, and this is the Galapagos, and this was a joint body and surface wave study of the mantle using an array around the Galapagos Islands here. This is another sort of regional scale view. And just to summarize their results, so they, in the very shallowest part of the mantle at 40 kilometers depth, they see this low velocity blob that extends sort of to the southwest. And in an east-west cross section, that shallow blob looks like this. As you go deeper, here at 80 kilometers depth, you start to see in this, so this is a north, south to north cross section here, you start to see this low velocity blob that ends up extending further south as you go down to about 200 or so kilometers. So this is consistent with a hot upwelling that's sort of centered beneath the youngest islands, Fernandina and Isabella. The volcanism is more widespread in the Galapagos than, say, at Hawaii, but this is consistent with the youngest volcanism being there. It's also consistent with receiver function studies that image changes in the transition zone. So their interpretation, again focusing on this south to north cross section, was that this low velocity curved column reflects subsolidus flow of the plume to the Galapagos spreading center. There's this fast velocity, high seismic velocity region, you know, in the upper 100 kilometers that they interpreted to be dehydrated material, and also where hydrous melting is occurring. And then they interpreted the shallow portion to be where silicate melting is occurring. This is just sort of ongoing or preliminary work. A model that we looked at to explain various aspects of the spreading center is shown here. And what I'm contouring here are predictions of melt production rate. So this particular model explains sort of the variability in crustal thickness along the ridge axis, as well as focused melt production beneath the islands. And the predictions of the temperature variations, if we subtract a 1D depth average temperature profile, so we can sort of compare it to the seismic velocity anomalies, we predict a more shallowly rising plume that starts to bend beneath the base of the lithosphere, not down near 200 kilometers depth. And this heterogeneity in the shallow mantle is difficult to explain with this reference model. Here we predict the melting rate sort of occurring near here, so it's not clear how you could get a fast and slow seismic velocity region just above it. These are leading to more questions about plume ridge interaction than we thought this sort of result would answer. I just wanted to throw this MT result showing evidence for dehydrated mantle on the side of what is the inferred melting zone, perhaps analogous to this, again suggesting that compositional heterogeneity is very important to seismic velocities. So one asks, you know, where is the deep or shallow melting regime above the Galapagos hotspot? In what directions are the melts migrating? You know, what portion of the melting regime is feeding volcanism at the islands versus where is it migrating north to the ridge axis? And Tushar Mittal, I believe, is here or will be here. He and Mark Richards have been working on this, so you can ask him about that process. And certainly composition, temperature, and perhaps melt content produce large variations in VC that we need to, VS, that we certainly need to understand. I'm sort of out of time, but I did want to just mention the process of getting melts out of the mantle beneath hotspots. And this is an interesting result by Lasky and others, surface wave study of the plume experiment. And the main story is that if you look at a cross-section along the islands, you can sort of image the base of the lithosphere. This is old Pacific lithosphere, around 80 kilometers depth. But they see large variations in seismic velocity well into the shallow lithosphere, up to 40 kilometers depth. And some of the local lows correspond to volcanic fields. So this is evidence that perhaps a combination of heat delivered by melt or melt itself can impart large variations in the shallow lithosphere beneath this thick lithosphere. So this leads to questions about how magma actually penetrates an 80 or 90 kilometer thick lithosphere. And we can ask Boris Kaus and Tobias Keller about how that might happen. Okay, I think I will end my talk there and take questions.
Thank you very much, Gareth. Got some quick questions? Mark.
Just a comment on the empty estimate for 10% melting. There's a quick back of the envelope which says that's probably not right, only because if the estimate of the amount of melting is order 10%, if there's 10% there and you've only made 10%, it's not moving. It's not separating. Right. So I suspect.
Yeah, likewise in that incipient melting zone, you know, the back of the envelope estimate of 1% melting is occurring where the total extent of melting.
But the rough rule of thumb is that the melt velocity relative to the solid is ordered the degree of melting over the porosity just by conservation of mass. The amount of melting and the amount of melt is the same, it's not separating. If you want it to separate fast, you can't have much melt. So
there is a possibility in that inversion. I believe they commented on this, you know, that there's a very focused low resistivity region shallower beneath the East Pacific rise, but they're just seeing smearing.
But if you take it at face value.
Yeah, I don't think 10% is, you know, there's a disconnect here, certainly, that we need to address.
Neil, sorry, did you have a question?
Yeah. In your model of the Hawaii, of the deep ecogite pool, you have two distinct pools, it seems to me. But the tomography seems to show one big blob that extends over the whole depth. Does that mean there's a problem with vertical resolution?
Well, that was a slide that I skipped over. So the initial results, which were just the Wolf et al. Body wave results, show this big blob. And you're right, the body waves don't cross very much, certainly above 300 kilometers. So there is a possibility of smearing that down, but it would have to be very, very high anomaly in the shallow part. But this joint body wave, body and surface wave study does constrain the velocities in the shallow part. And so it requires more slow material than the velocities that they do image in the shallow part. And so the inversions put it down deeper and even suggested a separation between the two.
Thanks. Yeah, just also a comment. I think the recently developed ambient noise analysis techniques in seismology really, for the first time, allow us to use surface waves to look at the really shallow part. In other words, from the Moho down to like 20 kilometers deep. And at least our results in the Lau Basin suggest that there's not super low velocities, like say from the Moho down to 20 kilometers deep. So that would suggest, you know, something more consistent with the key image that showed sort of a bit of lithosphere, or at least you know, not melt going all the way up to the Moho, rather than sort of increasing upward melt porosity, you know, like was implied by some of the melt experiment data. So that would be our interpretation of that result. And I think increasingly we'll be able to use the ambient noise technique to look at that structure and sort of that depth range. Because previously we had the active source, you know, that like you showed, that went down to about six, you know, to the Moho. And then we had Rayleigh waves and body waves that were sort of really large scale. So we couldn't image that 6 to 20 kilometer depth range, and now I think we can. And I guess my other comment is that some of those studies of plumes, especially like Galapagos, you have just a small number of stations that are all sort of right over the top. So I don't see how you can do body wave tomography, like, you know, since you have just a cone of rays that are coming up. And, you know, so you're going to really smear out things vertically. So I'd be a little bit worried about those imaging these oceanic hotspots unless you have the OBSs,
yeah,
you know, for a larger array like they did in Plume.
Well, the upper mantle structure that was shown by Bill Gomez was consistent with their surface wave tomography.
Okay.
And that was a joint surface and body wave inversion.
Oh, was it? Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay.
Back to your comment about
the surface waves can't go deeper than like 150. So
right. So you need both information to attribute what part of the body waves are being slowed. Yeah, Doug will tell you it's certainly right, of course. But
yeah, I'm sure Doug would.
Yeah. But I take your criticism or your comment. I think Doug should too. I mean, it's a very valid comment for sure.
Right. In the interest of keeping to time, I think we should probably move on to the next talk. We thank Gareth once again.